Well, no matter what the season or the weather, you are going to find insects somewhere. They might be in the house in the middle of the winter, but they're there. And if you want to know more about them, or maybe you want to get rid of them, or maybe you want to foster them, you've got come to the right place. Phil Pelletieri, retired UW Extension entomologist, with us today. It's great to have him back, and we can talk with him about Japanese beetles and yellow jackets and a whole lot more. You have questions, join in at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@WPR.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And Phil, great to have you back.
Nice to be here.
And you're doing well?
Doing well. Enjoying retirement.
Yeah, well, it's great to have you back with us. Have you, even though you're retired, you probably are still seeing a few insects or hearing about insects in one fashion or another?
Well, like anybody, I battle them in the backyard or enjoy them in the backyard, so I get that part of it. And the neighbors do stop by with little presents at times. So, yeah, it's still bopping along.
I'm surprised. I've seen a few more Japanese beetles this summer than I have actually saw last year at this time.
I'm kind of on the other side of it, and the hope I give people, and it's still my experience, is back about 10 or 12 years ago in most of Madison, it was like a science fiction movie.
It was terrible.
Sheer numbers, if you weren't treating your birch trees or whatnot, they were getting totally defoliated. I still live in a hot zone because I'm relatively close to a golf course, and I won't say I haven't seen them, but I've come to the point that there is no plants in my yard yet, and they've been out for almost a month, that I felt I needed to treat. And so that's the good news if you've been through the war for a number of years. The unfortunate thing is I do know there's parts of the state where they are still moving into, and then you get this 5 or 6 year minimum buildup where they just seem to get worse and worse. And again, the frustrating thing about that is because they migrate in from so far, no matter what you do to your plants, there are more coming, and you can't stop them from the source in most cases. And so it's a very frustrating insect.
And there's really not a lot you can do to keep them from hurting your plants.
Things like, the birch trees and the linden trees.
Roses.
There are systemics. The problem with the systemics and roses is they don't protect the flowers. And that's, of course, why you plant the plants. In some cases, I think people have changed some of the things that they plant just because they don't want to put up the battle. There's plenty of things that will slow them down, but with 2 months of them flying and, getting 5 days out of any product, whether it's organic or some of the more conventional treatments, it becomes very high maintenance. And it just is, as I said, it's a very frustrating insect to deal with for any gardener.
Anna in Fox Point has a question. Let's go to Anna. Thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. I was calling about monarch caterpillars.
Mm-hmm.
Last year, for the first time, I planted some red swamp milkweed and was very pleased to get caterpillars and noticed as they progressed that they were looking stranger and stranger. They were more black than you would expect.
Mm-hmm.
And then as they got to be almost, as it was almost time for them to pupate, sometimes they would kind of explode.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's OE, Afriocystis electroscura, I believe. And then this year, I'm noticing the same thing. I'm noticing that my caterpillars are looking strange. And I'm wondering, what do I need to do to get this out of my yard? Because I don't want to kill caterpillars.
Yeah, now, I be honest, I'm not familiar with the disease under that name. I will tell you, there's a bacterial problem. But more commonly, the way when you mention they explode, it sounds more viral to me.
And the
problem with that is that really there isn't a whole lot you can do. Now, we have this problem all the time in insect cultures. When you concentrate creatures and whatnot, and one gets sick, the disease spreads very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things you may consider, if you had that much success in getting small caterpillars, is bringing them inside and rearing them. But because of that history of problems, it's almost like each critter gets its own individual jar or container. So you have them isolated. I just don't know anything you can do for them out in nature other than, be honest, when you see a sick larvae, get it out of there. Because what happens with the virus is it's still contained. It's not spreading. But once they liquefy, there's just millions of virus particles getting spread. And that's why you get so much movement from this. But as I said, I don't know any disinfectant that will work. Where it's blowing in from, it's a little hard to say. But getting rid of cadavers and other things, burying them or something, I think is just a way of trying to cut down on the number of virus particles that are out there. So,
no, not a bad
idea.
Should
I cut my plants to the ground?
Well, I don't think it's in the plants. As I said,
okay.
I think it's topically spreading, you know, much like, you know, when you have a cold and viruses spread that way. And it's just disappointing because normally I would not anticipate 2 years in a row. As I said, you get these bad years, you get an epidemic, but then it seems to go away. And how many larvae have you been lucky enough to have, like, in a given summer?
Well, I have been bringing them inside, and I've been putting them in separate jars, and it's happening even inside. And so, so far this year, I've had four caterpillars. Mm-hmm. Three are relatively small still. It's the one that's gotten large that is looking ill.
It may just be that they're coming in already infected, because it does take some time to progress. And once you start to see the discoloration and whatnot, they're very far along. And as I said, because they kind of liquefy so quickly, that's what suggests to me that it's virally based.
Okay. Thank you very much. Okay.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And boy, have we been getting the photos up on our Facebook page, which is really a lot of fun. You may need to get over closer.
Yes,
to
this. There's one I can see.
I'll switch you to a different microphone there. There you go. Now you can go to that mic if you want.
Okay. Well, you know, because of the filaments.
This is from Scott.
Yeah, because of the filaments out of the back, it really looks like a mayfly. And what I can't get a good perspective on is how the wings are structured. It almost looks like they're not totally unfolded, so this may be a sub-imago. Mayflies go through this very weird transition where most critters, their final molt turns them into adult. Mayflies really have two molts that turn them into an adult, and this may be the pre-adult molt. And they have kind of a smoky appearance, and the wings aren't quite so. As I said, the first one was because of those filaments, a type of mayfly. Now, the second one.
This is from Owen, and he says, nature is one big restaurant. What type of insect is this? And it's one insect feeding on another.
Right. So the big black one looks like a bumblebee, but it's not. It's called a robber fly. And there are some robber flies that are great bee mimics, and they are predators. And what this one is feeding on is a species of weevil that I know as the imported green weevil. It is a species that we see more in the north, feeds on birch and a few other things, really doesn't cause much damage, but it's almost got this iridescent scaling to it, which makes it quite
attractive.
That's
cool.
A neat picture.
That is really a cool picture. Go to our Facebook page and take a look at these, because they're dandy photos.
Okay,
what
now
do we
the
got
next
here?
One. Okay, so that.
From
this is
Brandon.
This is the one
this
that I would have traded
Brandon.
My little sister or my big sister for back as a kid. This is a luna moth. And
okay.
Luna moths, although they're found throughout the state, are really, in many cases, especially in urban areas, very hard to find. Now, part of the reason that they're very short-lived as adults, and they make great bat food. So I think they're a little more common than people think. They just don't get a chance to survive long enough for people to observe them. But that very characteristic green color and the long tails, this is one of the four large wild silkworms we have in the state. We have a few other species of smaller wild silkworms. You know, they feed on walnut and a lot of other common plants. But as I said, some areas are a little more common. I've seen them in the Kettle Moraine. Finding them in Madison is really quite unusual, has been my experience. But it is a real trophy. And then you can tell the males from the females by the size of the antennae. And on the males, they're much bigger and more feathery because they use these to find the females. And so this looks like a male to me.
And these are some really nice photos. So as you listen today, go to our Facebook page and go to the left side of go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. You don't have to be a member of Facebook to go to it. And as you look at the page on the left side, it says posts to the page. And, you know, click on that and these photos are going to jump up. And I'm sure we'll be getting some more photos as the program goes along. Now, those are neat, especially the robber fly, was it? You called
yes.
it?
Yes. Yeah. Scyllid is the fancy name, and there are all kinds of robber flies in that. There's this one subgroup, as I said. They're the best bee mimics you've ever seen, and there are times until I can get them to stop and count the wings, because true flies have one pair of wings.
Yep.
Regular bees have two pairs of wings, but they kind of buzz the same way. But some of it, you can see the behavior, because robber flies will often sit on foliage and wait for prey to go by. They're very visual, and then they basically chase it down. And that's what you can see in this case. It chased down that weevil and then will chomp on it, which bees have no interest in chewing on other
insects. That is a really, really cool picture. Chris in Lake Geneva up next. Hi, Chris. Thanks for calling.
Well, thank you.
I'm raising Cecropias.
Mm-hmm.
I was lucky to find three of them on my button bush last year, and I managed to get them to survive the winter. I got two males and a female out of it, and so I wanted to mate the female, which that was an experience all on its own. And anyhow, I have got Cecropias coming out of my ears, and I was wondering, I really don't want to kill them. Is there anything I can do? Is there a good food source other than my button bush, which is kind of small, to mm-hmm. feed them with? Can I reintroduce them out to the wild as little guys?
Yes, you can. But one of the tricks that you find, even though if you read a book and you can see a relatively long list of host plants they'll feed on, it's been my experience that if you start them on a given plant, it's very difficult to get them to turn on to something else that normally would be their food. So,
okay.
You know, if you were starting something like an apple on a tree that's not sprayed, or a crab apple, honestly, are two, I think, common plants that usually have enough leaves. Lilac is another plant they will survive on. Birch would probably be another one. And, you know, as much button bush as you're willing to sacrifice, or if you've got any other neighbors that can contribute food to the cause, as I said, it's the problem of the bigger they get, the harder they are to shift. And I've seen them literally starve to death rather than chew on something else. It's almost like they get programmed and they just don't want to change. So that would be my one piece of advice.
Would they go for the seven sunflower? You know, it's a bush.
Not familiar enough with that plant. My guess is not. Most of the host range, honestly, is more deciduous trees.
Oh, okay.
You know, and but I mean, you can try it. As I said, you'll find out. You know, I'd only put a couple on it. Within a day or two. I mean, either they're very voracious. I mean, caterpillars like that will eat 3 to 4 times their weight in food a day. So they should just be going gangbusters if they find it to be suitable. Now, the other thing about plants is some plants have natural insecticides. And so you see different growth rates on different plants. And that's why something like apple really has very little natural defenses. And that's why it's a relatively good plant to feed something like this on, is that, as they said, they seem to thrive on it. And it's usually relatively easy to find an apple tree that's available.
What about wild cherry?
There are some other members of the wild silkworms that feed on wild cherry. I have never tried Cecropia. It would be worth a shot.
Uh-huh.
That's one I have not had experience with. I said usually I go to the crabs or the lilacs. I often would get calls on people that found individual larvae on a lilac. And as I said, the big lilac bushes are really quite common, and especially in older neighborhoods. So.
Yeah, there we go.
Okay, good. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Chris. And Chris is in Lake Geneva. Phil in Hebron, Illinois. Hi, thanks for calling.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Morning.
So, since April 10th, I've had 27 inches of rain here, which has caused the milkweed to just explode. And they're falling heavily enough since Saturday that the fragrance is a noticeable fragrance, which I've never noticed before. All that has led to the fact that as of yesterday afternoon, I had 8 monarchs, which didn't surprise me. But I also saw 3 viceroys at the same time. And I've seen one in my whole life. How is the mimic population related to the monarch population?
Yeah, typically, you find lots more monarchs than you would viceroys. That's kind of my experience. Is, you know, it's like 10-to-1 type of thing. Now, if you got in the right place, I mean, the host plants are different and the like, but it was interesting because I was out for a walk with the wife a couple days ago, and I saw what I thought a viceroy going by, but it didn't stop enough for me to really examine it to be 100% sure, because in my experience this year is I have seen more monarchs this summer than I remember in the last 4 or 5 years. Now, I was getting a little optimistic at last fall because, you know, with having now being retired, I have a little more time to go for walks, and I saw more monarchs in the fall migration last year than I probably have seen in the last 5 or 6 years. And so they said this is kind of a follow-through of that. Of there definitely seems to be more monarchs in Wisconsin. Now, some of this has to do with just the wind patterns and how the spring progresses. You know, it was a relatively nice spring. Things got up here. I have not been lucky enough yet to get any larvae on our swamp milkweed, which we find once in a while. But as I said, I would agree you'd expect to see more. And it has to be that way, because if you're mimicking a distasteful species and you're more common than it, you're not teaching the predators what's going on here. And so, mm-hmm. as I said, normally you expect something like the viceroy to be kind of few and far between in comparison.
There we go.
These viceroy Troy were very passive. They'd sit down, got a couple good pictures, much smaller than the full-size monarchs, with a nice even pane on the lower part of the wing. The orange pane was even instead of, you know, erratic up and down like they are with monarchs. So, I mean, they were viceroys, and I've never seen three together in my life.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting because the host plans of viceroys are quite common. The larvae are just the spookiest looking things you've ever seen. They look more kind of like a bird dropping and who knows what else. So I would encourage people to, you know, look up a viceroy caterpillar on the internet to see a picture in it. It's just a very strange looking animal. But I've only seen a couple of those larvae in my life. And as I said, seeing the adults, you got to get one stopped so you can take a good close look at it. But I really find that they're really very infrequent compared to the regular monarchs.
There we go. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Phil Pelletieri, our guest today, entomologist, distinguished faculty associate emeritus at the University of Wisconsin-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. I'm Larry Mueller. Cheyenne Lentz, our on-air producer, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Taking a look at insects here in the state with Phil Pelletieri. Thank you for joining us. All our lines are filled. The number 1-800-642-1234. If you have a photo that you maybe you've got an insect ID you'd like to have Phil to take a look at, go to our Facebook page. Our Facebook page title, The Larry Mueller Show. And go there and we'll take a look at it and see what we can get. Come up with. Jane and Rothschild next. Hi, Jane.
Hi. We have the red lily leaf beetle, and it showed up here at our house probably 5 or 6 weeks ago as the beetle, along with several friends having the same problem. And I used a neem oil spray on it and didn't see too many of the beetles. And for a while, then the larva and the excrement showed up. So I sprayed some more, and then I didn't see anything for a while. And now I have the beetles again. It seems like when I spray, you know, it does help. I don't see them for a while. But I guess my question is, because I understand they lay a lot of eggs, you know, will they overwinter, or can you just comment more on this beetle and
sure.
what to
well,
expect?
Unfortunately, you're in ground zero. The first red lily leaf beetles were found up in the Wausau area last year, mm-hmm. so they were state records. And so, you know, we don't have a lot of experience, but the type of beetle it's from, the leaf beetles, I think it's here to stay. And so even if you can magically kill everything that's attacking your garden, I think you're going to constantly have an immigration in. So this is going to be an annual problem. Neem, it sounds like you prefer more organic type products, and neem is,
right.
is a reasonable product. Another product I think you might consider that may give you a little bit more knockdown is I know the product is spinosad, S-P-I-N-O-S-A-D. But it's sold under Dr. Jack's Dead Bug Brew. It's also sold under Monterey Flower and Vegetable Spray. Neem has got some interesting properties. It's an antifeedant. It has some hormonal activity, whereas the spinosad has a little bit more of a traditional knockdown. Now, nothing kills eggs very well. And so, you know, timing is everything. And what I would suggest is it sounds like you do a good job of watching what's going on in the garden. This is a lot like asparagus beetle. When you see the first adults coming out from their overwintering sites attacking the plants, if you can shut the door then, you've got a much better chance for success. If you're a week or two late, what I expect to happen is it appears that you've got a knockdown, but you've already got larvae coming back at you. So this may be twice a year. That you're going to have to put up the defense because, again, you're going to get the overwinter adults laying that first generation. And then when those mature, that next generation that's coming on, these new red beetles that you're seeing are migrating in from the neighborhood. And now it will be interesting to see over time if this lessens as a problem. One of the interesting things that I picked up in my career, and I'm not the only person to observe this, is that when we get invasive species like this, they often, when they are first establishing themselves, seem to be the most problematic. And over time, things get better as things balance out. But how long that will take, I'm not sure. You know, we do anticipate this will continue to spread throughout the state, unfortunately. So, you know, we had a plant that basically had very little, if any, serious insect issues. And now all of a sudden,
suddenly,
it's going to be at least once and probably twice a year you're going to have to put up the fight.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Let's go back to our Facebook page for a minute. Mike sent us a photo of his hostas, and he says, Larry, something's destroying my hostas. I don't see any signs of slugs. What could it be and how to get rid of it? As you look at that, look at his photo, there's lots of holes.
Yeah, I mean, I still can't. Now, because the holes are relatively round and uniform, often with slugs, I tend to get more of an elongated hole. The other big culprit are earwigs. Earwigs love to feed on hostas.
Yeah.
Now, in some years, we've seen cutworms do the same thing, but it is not quite the cutworm pattern. Cutworms get bigger and almost looks more like rabbit or deer damage when they get large. I would ask if he's seen any earwigs running around. My experience in the Madison area is earwig numbers are very low.
Yeah,
my indicator plant for earwigs are marigolds, and my wife planted a basket of marigolds. I just watered it this morning, and I can see a little bit of nipping. But when they get serious, it looks like full-blown rabbit damage. I mean, there's not a leaf left on the plant. I'm just not seeing that. We've experienced some slug activity in certain cultivars of our hostas. It's been wet enough that that wouldn't surprise me. You know, the only way you can really confirm this is, you know, at about 10 o'clock at night, brave the mosquitoes and get out there with a flashlight and take a peek, because all this stuff's going on at night. But just my observation of the way those holes are presenting and whatnot, it looks more earwig-like. The only other thing that would do that is very small slugs. I mean, small slugs will give you the round holes. As they get bigger, then things are going to progress more. But it's such a random pattern the way it's going on. As I said, my first inclination is earwigs. And one of the things that you'll get sometimes is plants unfold. I call it the paper doll effect. But the injury is often earlier in the bud. And then when the leaf expands, it gives you multiple holes because it was chewed through.
Oh, sure. I wondered about that because there are so many holes.
Yeah, yeah. And so, you know, the interesting to do, you know, for plant health, this is nothing. I mean, the plant tolerates just fine. It's unfortunately a cosmetic damage. And slugs are always more difficult to deal with because they don't respond to insecticides. There are special baits that help a bit. But if it's real wet, the baits get washed away and you have to reapply them. If it's real wet, the slugs are happy as heck anyway. So it's really often quite a battle.
Well, thanks for that photo. And there are tons of other photos, and we'll get to some of them. There's one I have never seen an insect of the color of this. Of course, now I...
The yellow one that you had there?
There was a purple one.
Okay.
There was a purple one.
But
we'll get to that. Let's go to Bill in Madison next. Bill, thanks for waiting.
Hey, no problem. So here, in Madison, in my ornamental garden, I've left stands of jewelweed, the wild impatiens, and the Japanese beetles love that.
Mm-hmm.
And they're leaving the rest of my ornamentals, even the cannas, alone, which is great. But they're about halfway through the jewelweed. Mm-hmm. Now, they'd be really, really easy to knock down right now. But I'm wondering if I dusted them or sprayed them, would that preclude any new arrivals from going to the jewelweed?
No.
Yeah,
so one of the things that goes on, we know, is that they gang up on plants. And some of this has to do with the females giving off chemicals that attract the males. We also think that some of this has to do that the injured leaves give off volatiles. And so the experience I tell years ago of I had some Potentilla bushes in the front of the house. And I used to go out and hand pick them. And finally, it got frustrating enough because I'd never see a yellow flower. I did spray. And they stopped attacking my Potentillas, and they showed up on my neighbor's Cotoneaster. and so that's been my experience now. Is you know, some of the plants
I'm
that
I'm just going to let them go. I'm just going to let them eat the jewelweed.
Yeah, I mean that would be fine. The other thing is yeah, I think you're running a little bit of a risk that if you stop them on the jewelweed, not that other beetles won't find an interest there, but they may find something else to pick on, and then they'll start ganging up on that. And so, as I said, maybe you can use it kind of as an indicator. The other thing, though, is we're getting later in the season. You know, they've been flying for about a month. They'll probably be flying for about another month. And And so I expect things start to taper off. So if it did seem that you're starting to get some overspill into some of the plants that you prefer they don't feed on, I don't think there'd be anything wrong with kind of shutting the door once and just see what happens.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm just going to hope that the jewel weed lasts long enough.
Yeah. There you go, Bill.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Appreciate your call very much. Back to Facebook, because I found that photo, and is that violet? Would you say that's a violet color?
Yeah, violet to brown, and honestly, this caterpillar, yeah, this caterpillar can come in a couple different color phases, so it kind of fakes you out. In fact,
it is really cool.
Well, you know, it's got those are eye spots.
Eye spots. Yeah.
So those aren't eyes at all, and that helps identify this particular one. It is a tiger swallowtail. My guess, because they're down in Iowa, that it's more likely the southern and not the Canadian species.
This is Trish from Iowa, by the way.
When I was a student, we only recognized one species. But my colleague Mark Scriber was doing work, and he's a big butterfly guy. And what he found out is that if we feed the southern tiger swallowtails the food that the ones up in Canada would feed on, which is more aspen, they would starve to death. And vice versa, if we feed the Canadian varieties, sassafras and some of the other host plants we get in the south. And what he showed is that they are basically two separate species.
Oh.
And there's a tension zone right in the middle. Our vegetation tension zone in Wisconsin is the marking point. So as I said, it probably is a regular tiger swallowtail and not the Canadian species, but still a neat creature. And it looks like it's big enough that you got a pretty good chance of getting an adult butterfly in about 3 weeks if you're patient. And they're just neat creatures and great photographic subjects.
And I've got to go with one more before we go back to the phones. LaVon sent us a photo, she says, what is this beautiful creature? Its wingspan is 3 to 4 inches. It's kind of yellow
and so
brown.
This is another wild silkworm. This is called the imperial moth. And unlike most of the wild silkworms that make big cocoons above ground, this creature burrows into the ground to transform into the moth stage. And just like the other wild silkworms, very short-lived.
Beautiful.
More common now. When I was young, we never saw imperial moths in Madison. But the last 15, 20 years, they've really become quite common. And so this is a creature that I believe has extended its range northward somewhat because of the milder winters that we have. Don't feed as adults, very short-lived. I made a mistake one day. I had a beautiful one out in the parking lot of the archery club I belonged to, and I was going to go and shoot some arrows, and I was going to come back and collect it for taking pictures and the like. Well, in the half hour I was out in the swamp, the birds found it. And so all I had was wings. So it's neat that you can get that opportunity to take a picture of it. And they feed on oak and a lot of trees that are quite common in the state. And again, what I think was the problem is they had trouble spending the winter in the ground when it got overly cold. Now that it isn't quite as cold, we're finding better survival. So they are more common.
Kathleen in Milwaukee, thanks for waiting. Hi.
Hi, thanks so much for the program.
Sure.
I'm in a beetle battle with a couple of different kinds of beetles, grapevine beetles, which I have no idea how to treat. And then someone suggested to me to treat my Japanese beetles with milky spore bacteria. And I tend to lean organic, so the idea of a bacteria attacking them, but my understanding is it stays and multiplies in your lawn. So I'm wondering what you would have to say about either of these.
Well, a couple things. There's some exciting stuff coming down, but I'll start with the regular milky spore. It is a bacterial disease that you put the spores in the environment. If the larvae feed on it, it causes an infection, and their blood turns kind of white and milky. That's where the name comes from. Right. But in what that does is increase the number of spores in your yard. So if you told me that your problem was your lawn was suffering and dying because there's so many beetle grubs in it, the milky spore disease would be one of the alternatives. The problem is that most of us that experience plant damage in our yard, they're migrating in from down the road, and there is the milky spore disease in your lawn is not going to make any difference with that. Now, what's coming down the pike, my colleague Chris Williamson, who works a lot with Japanese beetle in golf courses and other things, has found or is working with a company that has a strain of milky spore bacteria that you can spray and will kill the adult beetles. But it has not been labeled yet for that use. So it's experimental is the best way to put it. But it, Chris has talked about it is really outstanding. And so one would suspect this is a big enough market that we would see this product reach the marketplace. But I can't really tell you when that's going to be. Now, the problem on your grape, explain the beetle. Is it this the kind of tannish critter with four or five black dots on the back and it's relatively big?
I found him sitting on top of the mailbox, and I brought him in the house and looked him up in my little book. And then I felt bad for keeping this creature in the house forever. I didn't know what to do with him. Mm-hmm. I was going to flush him. But it's a big beetle, and they do I'm just afraid they eat everything on the grapes.
No. My experience with it is, you know, they're a neat-looking beetle, and you look on the underside, and they're also kind of a dark metallic green to them. So they're, again, a great photographic subject. And although the adults do feed, I've never seen them numerous enough to do other than just some minor cosmetic damage. So I really would not worry. The grubs you find in rotting wood and other things, and so they're really not an issue there. And as I said, other than the adults having a bit of a fondness for feeding on grapes, I've never seen a plant defoliated to the point that I would be concerned. So I don't think there's any problem there.
Here we go.
Oh, good, because I let him go.
There you go. Thanks a lot, Kathleen, for calling. Appreciate it. I want to give Mary a chance from Michigan to join in. Mary, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hello. I just wanted to share that we had a very fun weekend on our pontoon boat. And Sunday night or early evening when we were wrapping everything up, we noticed some swarming, and they were yellow jackets, and I got off the boat and we noticed a little bit more swarming, and my husband grabbed a rake and we carefully lifted some of the puffy pontoon seats, and there was a nest the size of, I say a basketball, he says a football, but you know, we had to clean it up and spray it down and hose it down quite a bit, and now everything's settled down. But I was just wondering, because of kids and dogs, we hate to have to keep spraying, but they do seem to want to find, like, the cubby holes where the anchors are and stuff like that to hang out in.
Sure. Well, the one thing is that nest was established probably back in May with a single queen, and then everything is built from there. And that's probably the one thing you can try to exploit in their biology is that if you and it take you got to be very observant because the numbers are so low it doesn't get your attention. Typically, what happens with yellow jackets is we get into August and September when the nests are much bigger, and then people all of a sudden discover, and you know, it feels like it happened overnight, but this has again been festering for a couple months. And if you treat it at the right time, it's like shutting a door. There's only one queen, and when she's dead, the colony's taken care of. Now, what makes this difficult is the proper time to treat a nest is when everybody's at home, and that's not the middle of the day. So sometimes when people treat, we get the problem of the workers that come back. And I wonder what happened is a lot of the workers are out doing their thing, and when you move the boat, they couldn't find home. But once you brought it back to the dock, which is the normal place that they would expect, you start to get this activity. And then with all the things that were going on, they probably got quite agitated. So it's kind of, you know, you observe and treat. I don't know. You know, if this was such an occurring problem that you said, I got to do something preventatively, then what I would suggest is long about the last week of May, first week of June, is to treat those little openings where they're hiding, or
okay,
potentially hiding. And what you're doing is basically killing them before they chance to really get established. And mm-hmm, that would be the time, because they overwinter as queens, single queens, and then, as they said, they've got to find a good place. And some like to make their nests out in the air, the open air, and some species always make it in cavities or other protected sites. And
there you go. Thanks.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it.
You know, I would say, you know, for when they go into cavities, and like, I like dust better than sprays. When the nest is out in front of you and you can see it, then the aerosol wasp sprays you get are the best products to use.
Facebook question from Ryder: do parasitic wasps work for fly control in barns?
Yes, but you've got to do your homework. There are numerous families and thousands of species of parasitic wasps, and they match up. Some only attack certain things. So you've got to make sure you get parasites that are made for flies. And I would even warn you that you've got to check your supplier, because there are some parasites that work much better in northern climates like Wisconsin. Other ones work very well in Arizona, and you don't want to mix them because they won't go. So, you know, make sure you've got a good supplier. For something like this, I would go to the people that are producing them. So, you know, companies like Gardens Alive are a great source for all kinds of organic things, but they're basically a middle person. They're getting their product from somewhere else and moving it. In this case, I would go to one of the supply houses, do a little homework, make sure that they're talking about the same thing that you've got. Now, the problem with these parasites is they do a good job, but you have to keep releasing them on a regular basis. And again, for livestock producers, there are formulas. You take so many parasites per week per head of cow, or honestly, calves, you need more parasites because they defecate more and there's more problems with it. So there are formulas, and you release them, and you got to keep your sanitation up. This is not an excuse for not cleaning things up is part of it. But under the right conditions, they have proven to be very effective. And as I said, that's why I think it's best to associate yourself with one of the producers, because they'll kind of walk you through this, the kind of things that you have to consider. But they definitely do work. They work in horse barns, too. They're great for house flies. Now, when you get into some of the biting flies, like stable flies and deer flies, that's a different fly, and honestly, the parasites don't help us much there.
Lee in Green Bay up next. Hi, Lee. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, good morning. I've got a field on my property of between 5 and 6 acres, and it's got a beautiful stand of milkweed. Now, I've had some monarchs out there, not a lot. There were two of them together. I presume they were mating yesterday. And I would just like Phil to comment on part of their life cycle in our area. What exactly are they doing during our, you know, summer, our period?
Well, it depends when they get here. You know, if they get up here too early, to be honest, there's not enough milkweed up to be very good for them. We're at that time of the year now that they easily got a chance to run one and maybe two generations, just depending on the way the fall goes. So, you know, hopefully that female will start laying eggs relatively quickly. It's probably about a 4-week process to get the caterpillars up and make chrysalises. You know, it's fine to let nature run its course, but we find with insects that the normal mortality runs, you know, 92% to 95% in nature. So she lays a lot of eggs, and not a lot of them end up becoming adult butterflies. That's why many people have gone to the practice that if they get lucky enough to have small caterpillars, is to bring them in the house and protect them from some of the natural predators and problems. Unfortunately, the early call we had is the disease problem sometimes steps in the way. But you can get a higher success rate, but it takes a lot of babysitting. You basically got to bring them fresh, new leaves to eat at least every couple days. You got to clean the cage, those kind of things. But if you got, you know, children around, it's just a great, fun thing for a project for them. And then if you get lucky enough to get a chrysalis and then watch that, you know, change colors over time, cool, and then get the adult out, it's just fun. So, you know, the whole process takes 4 to 5 weeks. And then it's just a question. Usually when the day lengths are starting to get short, I'm thinking about the first week of September or so, it seems like they get the wanderlust to them, and we start getting them migrating. I remember back when I was driving truck in college and whatnot for the summers, just about the time the monarchs migrated, it was about time to get ready to go back to school. It seemed to be the way things were. But back then we started, you know, in the middle of September, so... So we'll definitely got time for one full generation. And as I said, if things are excessively warm, because that makes things happen faster in the insect world, there may be a chance for a partial second generation.
I had some milkweed that came in a volunteer right in the wrong spot in my flower garden, but I left them there because I felt so good to see a couple of monarchs on those half a dozen milkweed plants. It was a great feeling. And just yesterday, as a matter of fact.
Well, my observation, at least in the Madison area, is there's more monarchs flying around now than I remember in the last 3 or 4 years. So
we had Bonnie in Whitefish Bay wondered what sorts of things might destroy monarch eggs on common milkweed. She said, we see monarch eggs, but within 24 hours, they're all gone. They disappear. She says we do have milkweed beetles.
Probably not feeding on that. To be honest, earwigs are good, pretty good predators of things like that. And there could be other things, but that's what I expect. Nighttime predators probably being more of a problem.
Carl in River Falls has a question for you. Hi, Carl.
Hi, I've got a comment about Colorado potato bugs, the striped kind.
Yes.
I've had them for years in my garden and tried every kind of poison, including stamping and squishing and everything else. And someone suggested to roll the potatoes in sulfur. And I've done that for 2 years now and have not seen one bug ever since doing that. Any comment about?
Now, you're putting the sulfur on the tubers when you plant, or are you putting the sulfur on the foliage as it's growing?
I'm putting it on the seeds, the potatoes.
Seed potatoes.
Tubers. Seed potatoes.
Yep.
Yeah. That I can't see. It doesn't move through the plant. I mean, we use powdered sulfur for controlling not so much beetles, but mites and a couple other things. It has some efficacy.
You might have just gotten lucky, Carl.
Yeah, Colorado's...
I mean, I had them so thick that they destroy my eggplants, they destroy my potatoes, and my neighbor's got them, and I keep telling him to try it. And next year he's going to try it also, but I have not seen one bug in my garden.
Well, that's very good.
Yeah, you know...
Web is working.
It's been a tough critter to watch because, you know, over my career... Things that used to work very well are don't work at all. I mean, there's a lot of resistance. There are some products, but again, this is an insect that if you've been lucky enough to grow things without it, you know, sometimes people have never seen it. But once it seems to show up, my experience is it does not want to go away. And so that's very interesting that you've seen that. But as I said, sulfur by itself, there potentially if there was dusted sulfur on the leaves, that may affect their feeding patterns a little bit. But I can't see how treating the tubers would last long enough. And as I said, it doesn't move through the plant. I mean, other than being a nutrient to the plant. I mean, we use sulfur at times for the nutritional needs of a plant. But how it would slow down beetles that show up, you know, 4 and 5 weeks later.
On the other hand, it doesn't cost much. And if it's working, I just keep doing it, Carl. Thank you so much for calling. Phil Pelletieri, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks so much for joining us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, entomologist Phil Pelletieri. Lots of people online. The number to call, 800-642-1234. And if you have a chance, go to our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Like the page while you're there, by the way. That would be great, too. But take a look at the posts to the page. It's over on the left side. There are so many photos, really cool insect photos. And here's one we have up there now from Jessica, who wonders, I found this moth at the barn at Harvest Moon in Poinette. What is it?
Okay, so this is the third species of wild silkworm. This is Polyphemus.
Really pretty.
Right, and you know, and we were talking about the Cecropias earlier. So the four big species that we see in the state, we've had representations of today, which is kind of fun.
Yeah.
Again, short-lived as adults. This one, maybe Cecropia is the most common, I think, especially in urban settings. Polyphemus, the second most. Luna, and then Promethea, which is found only on wild cherry, and it's a little bit smaller. If you find them, you find buckets of them, but they're a little. You have to go basically hunt them down. But
wingtip to wingtip, that looks 4 or 5 inches, maybe.
Oh yeah, definitely. I mean, so these are as impressive as the big exotic creatures you see in the Amazon and in the like, and they happen to be natives here. And then we have another picture down there. We had one earlier of another imperial moth. Wow, I mean, we could make a calendar from these pictures, Larry. I mean
these
amazing.
Are just gorgeous. And then here, Elizabeth sent one of a caterpillar. She said, couldn't believe how much it grew in one day.
Right, and she's got them on her caterpillar there. And so, as I said, the amazing thing is these things are processing 3 to 4 times their body weight a day in food. So the whole growth pattern is really mind-boggling when you think it from a human perspective. And if they're eating less than that, things aren't going well for them in most cases. Now, it's quite common if you keep caterpillars for a day or two before they're ready to make their cocoon, if they're a moth, or make the chrysalis, if they're a butterfly, they stop eating. And so you know something's going on, but that's when they're full grown or when they're going to molt their skin.
And then one more before we go back to the phones from Louise. This is a small, fuzzy white insect.
Right. So, and she means real small. I mean,
yeah,
we're talking
real
something
small.
That's probably about a millimeter and a half or so. So this comes from a group of creatures we call woolly aphids. And so it is a type of aphid that secretes this polysaccharide that is almost like cotton candy is the best way to think of it. And sometimes these filaments can be three or four times as longer than the body. And so all you see is this flying fuzz ball is probably the best way to describe it. Woolly alder aphid is the most common. We see this on maple, but there are a number of species in the state. And as I said, when you catch them right, there can be a lot of them flying in the air, and it looks kind of strange. But if you get one to slow down and look closely, there will be little legs and little antennae. And as I said, it comes from this group that we define as woolly aphids.
Ray and Rhinelander, thanks for waiting. Hi. Ray, are you there? I wonder if we lost Ray. Well, let's try Gary in Clam Lake then. Let's see. Oh, nuts. Gary in Clam Lake, call back. I lost you somehow. Let's go to Cheryl in Conover. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi, I heard you talking about the milkweed plant, and ironically, I bought a milkweed plant at our garden center up in Eagle River, and this lady came up to me and she said, why would you put that in your garden? I spent my entire youth cutting them down on our farm. And I said, because of the butterflies. Now, you know, I'm not as well-versed as a gardener, but I have a perennial garden. So I planted it in my perennial garden, and I really don't know how big it's going to get or whatever, but can I divide it maybe and put it out on my property? Because my property is natural. Mm-hmm. We only cut a certain amount of grass, and it's not quaffed. It's,
sure. Yeah.
Because I have two acres with pines, and you know, we're trying to let the prairie kind of like let it go back, and I've got black-eyed Susans and everything growing in the prairie from not mowing it.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, you know, if you've got the plants in your garden, to be honest, when it starts to seed, it will throw a lot of seed. And although the success rate for seed is pretty low,
you know,
we're talking a couple percent, it may naturalize and move in anyway. I mean, milkweed seems to like somewhat disturbed ground. You know, so the prairie would be, but, you know, where you got the trees and whatnot, that's not a place you expect it to be happy with.
Right.
Yeah, it is not, I never considered a real aggressive weed compared to some other plants that you tend to battle with, because it's, you know, unless you're growing it for butterflies, most people would not find it acceptable. But we're seeing this whole transition. I see milkweed all the time now in people's gardens.
Everybody's got milkweed in our neighborhood.
People are trying to help out as much as they can. You know, swamp milkweed will support monarchs, and so will butterfly weed. So anything in the true milkweed family is the only plants that will support it. And, you know, we dropped a caller from Rhinelander, but his question, he was a little frustrated because the monarch hasn't showed up, but a whole bunch of other critters. And there are other animals that utilize milkweed, and it's kind of an exclusive group. There's a couple, three beetles. There's a milkweed tussock moth. There is a yellowish aphid that you find on milkweed. Mm. And these all kind of share the resource. I mean, I wouldn't consider one detrimental to the monarch.
Yeah.
There's plenty of milkweed out there. And so, as I said, I wouldn't worry about that. And, you know, you hope you put the plants in there. And if you're patient, maybe not every year, but you'll start to at least rear some monarchs. And, you know, in fact, there's discussion on a national level. I just picked this up in the paper in last week of planting a big corridor of milkweed through the Midwest and to try to supplement and help the butterfly populations out, because they've been really be getting knocked around so much in the last 5 to 10 years.
There we go. And
oh, my goodness.
there are so many wonderful photos on our Facebook page. I just can't believe it. Carrie, a moth?
Okay, so this is a more interesting story, because this is a native
huge.
Of Mexico.
Oh,
this moth is called
in her garage.
Yes, it's called a black witch. It is a large cutworm, the biggest cutworm we see. And the plants it feeds on are not found anywhere, maybe a little bit in Texas. But we do almost on a yearly basis get some blowing up here. Now, what's amazing is, you know, this again is a moth with about a 4-inch wingspan. And it has a very intricate color pattern on the wings. Are very attractive.
But
the other thing, when I look at this moth, the wings are perfect. It's like it just came out of a cocoon. But yet, as I said, I know it has had to migrate 1,500, 2,000 miles minimum. Probably got caught in, you know, one of those strong southerly airflows. And before the day of having digital cameras and email and whatnot, you know, if I saw one of these once every 5 or 6 years, I was lucky. And again, the only reason somebody would send it in, because it's so neat, honestly, it appears to be a little more common than we thought, because now it's so easy for people to take pictures and send them to somebody that might know. And so it seems almost every year goes, and I'll see three or four of these pictures minimum.
That's beautiful.
But yeah, that's a real trophy, as I said. It's something that you may never again in your life see a black witch.
And they've got a kind of a ruler right next to it.
Yeah. They're much like the wild silkworms. We're talking an animal with 4 to 5 to 6 inch wingspan. And so it almost reminds you of a bat or something, especially if it was flying. That's the first thought you'd probably have of it.
Thanks so much for sending that, Carl or Kerry. Emery sent us a racket-tailed emerald.
So Emery does exquisite photography.
Yeah.
He was nice enough to share probably 5-6 times a year, share pictures to me. And the difficulty of getting that kind of close-up on some of these species of dragonflies, which tend to be kind of nervous animals themselves, is just amazing. It's great. Early in my career, we did not have the kind of field guides for people to be able to identify things like dragonflies and damselflies. But there's been a number of books that have come out recently, and so I found a lot of people. I mean, that's what people need to get an interest in something, is you got to give them a resource. And as I said, so if you're interested in dragonflies, there's a number of books out there now that you can utilize. Some species are kind of hard to find. Some are associated with big rivers. We've got, the Heinz Emerald, which is only found in Door County, basically, and the like. So, fun group to work with.
And we'll be talking more. Phil's with us right up until 12:30 today. We're going to take a quick look at the news, the weather. We'll find out what else is in store for us here on the IdeasNet. And you can join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Back after the news. Thanks so much for joining us today on the IdeasNet as we take a look at the world of insects with Phil Pelletieri, entomologist extraordinaire, distinguished faculty associate emeritus, headed the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab for a long, long time. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks so much for joining us. We're getting so many wonderful photos on our Facebook page. You can post yours at The Larry Mueller Show. That's the title of the Facebook page. Again, you don't have to be a member of Facebook to go on and look at our page, at least. And if you want to like our page, we'll send you regular updates on upcoming show topics. So that's kind of cool, too. If you want that, just click like on the Facebook page, and we'll send them along. And here's Rob with another wonderful photo.
This is the last of the wild silkworms. This is Cecropia. Again, what I find probably the most common one. One of the common names I've seen it referred to is robin moth, and I think it's a kind of, the reddish brown.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
On the thorax and like. But yeah, those are just neat creatures.
And here's one that's pink and black and white from Sue.
So this is from the group that we call the tiger moths. You can see that because the adults now, many of the tiger moths are various woolly bear caterpillars that we see. And I can't tell you the exact species without seeing a better view of the hind wings. It has pink in there, but depending what the stripes and spots and whatnot, there's about 4 or 5 species of tiger moths that we get in various parts of the state. They're really quite common, and they're very stunning as adults.
Beautiful. Jane in Green Bay has a question for you, so let's go to her. Jane, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi there. I was wondering if you could tell me the best way to control ants up north at the cottage.
In the cottage or out in the lawn?
Well, it's both. Mainly it's out in the lawn, but they're starting to come in. And I only go up there like every 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. I find them crawling in the cottage and a lot of dead ones. And nests out in the yard. I believe they're either carpenter ants or fire ants. They will bite you.
Okay, so I think you've got two different kinds of ants. And they look very similar. Now, the big ones that will bite, that make the big mounds out in the yard, we call field ants. And there's a number of different types. Now, the interesting thing, field ants really don't have much interest in coming into structures. Carpenter ants are usually the same size, in some cases the same color patterns, and they often will get into structures. So I'd expect both. But as I said, that's why I was very interested where you find them. Now, the easy thing for me to say to control ants is you find the queen and kill her and you've solved it. But it gets very problematic for both these, because in the case of the field ant, she might be 2 feet deep in the ground and she doesn't come out. And in the case of carpenter ants, the nests are often very secluded. And what's hard to say is, do you have a nest in the cottage or do you just have some ants that are crawling around? Now, I'm a little suspicious if you're finding winged ants, dead or alive, or piles of dead ants in the cottage. That's hard to explain unless there's a nest somewhere in the structure. So let's talk about options.
I don't find piles of them, and I've never found winged ones.
Okay.
It seems like there's nests outside, and when you disturb them, they come out in full force.
Okay.
Some of them are reddish, and then you can see like a little trail in the lawn, and they'll lead all over the other parts of the lawn and sometimes up to the foundation, too.
Okay. Well, you know, I think I would start with the lawn nest and then see where it goes. So the secret here is to get the queen, and the only thing that I have found to be effective is to go with a crowbar or some other kind of tool so that I can make channels deep in the ground. And so usually I'll disturb the nest, you know, just to kind of see where the main entrances are, jab this pole or rod down in the ground as best I can, make three or four of those channels. And then whatever ant material, you know, lawn and garden, there's all kinds of materials that will work. But what I'll do is I'll mix it up in a bucket, you know, the normal directions, a teaspoon to a gallon. And then I pour it down those channels. So it's soaking deep, or what we would call drenching. And then if you want to, you can even cover that with untreated soil or whatnot, so there's nothing exposed to the top. But by that kind of individual drench treatment, we've had much better success in controlling it, and anything less than that. Now, for other ants, I'd often tell you use baits, you know, and the idea is that the workers take the baits back and feed everybody. But field ants, we have got no baits that I find to be very effective. And so this unfortunate spot treating of a nest. And those nests will last for 10 to 12 years. And so it's not as if, you know, you can kind of wane them out. They're very long-lived. Now, with carpenter ants, you know, if we knew where it was, just a little spot spraying would work, but the nests are very difficult. You know, for people to get overly frustrated, there are some products that the pest control companies can spray on the outside foundation that will take care of it. But, you know, I think what I would do is try to deal with these field ant nests that you've got in the yard and just get rid of them, and then see if that stops the problem with them coming in.
Good luck. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call, Jane. I want to give Mary and Eau Claire a chance to join us as well. Mary, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. I have a set of two questions. Something started devastating my columbines while they were flowering. They didn't flower as much this year. And then this wasp came along, and it spent a week scrutinizing and going up and down the stems. I mean, literally a week. I'd go out there, and it was just at it for hours, going up and down the stems. And then the plant started to regenerate. But now, so I'm wondering what that wasp was eating.
What I'm guessing, so it seemed that the leaves just disappeared?
Yes.
Okay.
Some of them had, you know, and looked malnourished. And
Well, there's two things I find on columbine, and it was interesting in my own yard what I observed. So there's a little critter that lays its eggs, and you get these funny little blotches on the leaves, and that's a leaf miner, and that I don't think is what was going on for you. But what you do see is a small green worm that we call a sawfly. Now, sawflies look like caterpillars, but they grow up to be something different. And it is a very wasp-like creature. And what I'm not sure of, my first inclination is what you saw is a predator wasp that was searching on the columbine for caterpillars to use as prey, or for sawfly larvae to use as prey. That would make more sense. The other possibility is that was an adult sawfly, but I can't think why it would stick around. They wouldn't waste their time on a plant that doesn't have leaves, because they have to lay their eggs. And in my experience with columbine sawfly, there's just one wave. And the adult I would describe, most people would describe closer to a fly-looking creature than a wasp, even though taxonomically it is a wasp. Whereas if it was more an elongated, typical classic wasp, I think that was a predator. And again, it was just looking for more prey. It might have had some success in the past in finding sawfly larvae, and it was just looking for some more. And it was going through that search pattern of going through all the stems and whatnot, hoping to find a little green worm to pick up on.
Mm. Well, it was impressive, the dedication it showed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, question number two. Have you, we had way too much tansy in the yard, and I read up on it, and the sources said that tansy used to be used as an insect repellent. So I tried, getting rid of the tansy, you know, scattering the leaves around the plant. This is an experiment to see if it might repel insects from some of our garden plants. Have you ever heard of this? And
does it work?
Yeah. Well, there are all kinds of interesting chemicals in plants. Some of them have insecticidal properties. Some of them have repellent properties. What makes this kind of a complicated story is with the tens of thousands of different insects, it's very unusual for something to be a repellent right across the board. So many times when we're talking about repellents were things that will repel ants, they won't cross the thing. So even something like mint oil, if you put on your doorstep, you'll notice the ants don't want to walk across it. It does have a repellency to it. Some people would find something that they could put in their drawers to keep clothes moths away. And, you know, there's some things that have repellents there. But one of the things when you talk about repellents, usually you've got to take the leaves of the plant and crush them to release the repellents from the leaves to begin with. And then the question is, how long will that product remain before it starts to degrade? So it would not surprise me at all. There's some interesting properties in tansy, but what it would work for, and in particular to expect the leaves to work. Now, if you had powdered leaves and you sprinkled it on your broccoli and it made the worms go away, I could see where that could happen, but you almost have to take it to that level. And then again, within a matter of a week or so, I would expect the product to probably degrade to a point that it would not be effective anymore. And so there's often some truths to it, but the universal repellent within a plant, it doesn't work. Much like, you know, you used to see the advertisements for these mosquito plants that you're supposed to put on your back porch and keep the mosquitoes away. And it turns out that, yes, if you take the leaves and crush them, there is a citronella oil-like product that has repellency to it. But that's the truth. It's got to be ground up and applied in order to work. And just the intact plant as it sits there is totally ineffective because the mosquitoes are never being exposed to the repellent compounds that are in there. And so, as I said, sometimes you have to dig a little deeper to see what they're really talking about and what you'd expect would work and not work.
Yeah, very interesting. Thank you so much, Barry, for calling. Appreciate your call. And Ray and Rhinelander, your turn. Hi, Ray. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Phil, thanks for being on. You're wonderful. I hope they don't cut the budget or they cut your scientificness out, because that would be horrible. Larry, thanks for having him on.
Sure.
Quick question. Dragonflies. I know you've covered a lot today, Phil, and thanks for covering about the monarch butterfly stuff. It helped me out. I can tell the people up here everything about what we're seeing in that. But, you know, I'm out hiking a lot up here. I'm all over the place. I see these three large dragonflies, and the order of size from smallest to largest are blue, green, and then this yellow one that I see every once in a blue moon. But it's just, it's so big. Is it a native? What can you tell us about our largest dragonflies? And I'll make your comments all there. And thanks for everything you do.
Sure, thanks.
Thank you.
Well, it turns out the biggest dragonfly we see in the state is Anax junius, the green darner, and it does have some blue forms or blue abdomens on it. But in that size range, there's at least another 10, 12 species you could expect to see, and I would almost have to see them because, you know, when you start to get away from some of the more common and very distinct ones, we're talking about the number of stripes on the thorax and whatnot to properly identify them. So unfortunately, I can't distinguish without pictures, and then even then the pictures would probably have to be in some pretty good detail to be sure. But definitely Anax is an interesting one, because we know we get migrants of that dragonfly from down south in Kentucky and elsewhere, but there's also evidence that we have breeding populations. Now, when somebody sees them early, it's usually a migrant that blows up here. And it's a pond butterfly. or excuse me, a dragonfly. You know, some are river species, some are, you know, use streams, but this one uses kind of the old classic pond, farm pond type of thing for breeding and are, you know, very mobile. So again, as I had talked about, if you're getting some interest in dragonflies, start looking. There's a book called Dragonflies of the North that's out there. There's a book that Carl and Dorothy Legler were co-authors with on Wisconsin dragonflies that you can still chase down. That was my first Wisconsin dragonfly book to work with. And, you know, originally they had published that just with pictures they had taken and color Xerox and staple it together and whatnot. But as I said, what it finally gave us is the kind of field guides that you need. The one thing I would caution you is make sure it's regionalized because, you know, the dragonflies in the Northeast is not, we'll have many of the same species, but we'll have some different ones. So try to get something that's kind of for the upper Midwest if you're looking. But there are at least three or four books out there that could help you in some detail. And they'll tell you when they fly, what regions they're more common in, you know, what kind of water habitats. You know, some of these things have three-year life cycles. Some of them have 2 to 3 generations a year. It just depends on the species.
And as long as we're talking about books and information, Ed in Galesville wondered where he could get more information on the habits of wasps and just general information on wasps.
Oh, boy.
That's
depends
a tougher
on what,
one.
What groups, yeah. You know, my colleague Bob Jean worked a lot with the social wasps. So we're talking things like the yellow jackets and some of those hornets. And they're really very fascinating. E.O. Wilson wrote a book on wasps and wasp biology. It may be a little bit more, but if you really want to get in the detail and all the very intricate relationships and the like, those are the kind of books that I think you would look for. So as I said, E.O. did a book on social insects, and that's what these groups are, where you have queens and workers and, mm-hmm. you know, kind of divisions of labor. And as I said, that would be at least one book I could think of you could start with that would give you some idea. And you know, my colleague Bob, you know, would go down to the Amazon and whatnot and study some of the species there that have some very fascinating biologies and different strategies. I mean, it's interesting how the ones in the north kind of have to follow certain rules. They overwinter as queens, whereas is in warm climates, they don't work that way, so they can reuse their nests and do all kinds of things that our species never do.
Right? Yeah. Sandy in Door County, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I met up with a really, I would say, large beetle-looking bug, black, about 6 weeks ago on my bedroom carpeting. And I knew that smashing it was probably not going to be the way to go. My vacuum cleaner was nearby, so I sucked it into the vacuum cleaner, and immediately there was this horrible smell. I knew it was a stink bug. My vacuum still smells. Yeah. And I'm just wondering how prevalent those are in Door County. I know they like orchards.
Mm-hmm. Well, it turns out it's a whole family of true bugs. And interesting enough, some of them are good guys because they eat other insects, they're predators, and some of them are plant feeders. And there's, as I said, a number of different species. You know, the one that we've been most concerned about, and one of the ones that I tease was one of the reasons why retirement looked quite appealing is the brown marmorated stink bug, which has been such a problem out east, both as an agricultural pest, but also as a house invader in the fall. And just as you described, people would say you suck them up in the shop vac and it just smells for a long time. I don't think that's what you had. In fact, the other part of it is when you said it looked like a beetle at first, we do have some beetles that have defensive compounds too. And so it doesn't necessarily have to be a stink bug, but one of the traits of all the stink bugs is they have glands on their abdomen that they use that are very distasteful and very strong smelling to help protect them from predators. So that's one group that they all smell. But as I said, there are other insects out there that it could be. And you definitely have a couple dozen species of relatively common stink bugs if you really go looking for them, but it's an outside animal. I'd be more likely to be on your plants outside rather than coming in as a big mistake on their part. It's because there's nothing inside that you know can support their life. So
there we go. Thanks, Andy, for calling. Appreciate it. Mary in La Crosse, hello to you.
Hi. We had an interesting thing happen here. I live on the very, very south end of La Crosse, and there are some little pond areas that collect water. But on Monday, July 13th, about supper time, a huge, huge one of those winds came through with just a very light rain. But the winds were strong enough to knock plants over and things like that. Then about 7 o'clock, I looked out my front window, and there was a swarm of swallows. And, I mean, it looked like there were 50 to 100 swallows, and they were in a huge swarm, and I could tell they were trying to catch something. And I thought at first they were maybe fish flies, but then the longer I looked, they were so fast it was hard to see, but they were dragonflies.
Mm-hmm.
It looked like hundreds of dragonflies, and I wondered how common that might be and how in the world they found each other.
Yeah. You know, it's something that's been observed quite a few times that you get these literally clouds. You know, when I think of a swarm, I think of mating swarms and whatnot that are a natural part of the biology of the animal. And we know that's not what's going on here, because sometimes when you see these groups of dragonflies together, it's not even just one species. It's different species,
different
which right
ones.
Away is, you know, kind of an odd thing. And in some cases, it was suspected that it was a migratory thing, so it was more common in September or so, when we would normally expect things to start heading south if they needed to. But at this time of the year, that definitely couldn't be. So now, dragonflies being predators, you know, I've seen cases where you get congregations where you'll get swarms of little midges, and then the dragonflies would prey upon those, and so you would kind of concentrate them. And then, of course, the birds pick up on that, and they can feed on the things that are feeding on the midges. And so that would be my first inclination, is that you had something that was drawing all the dragonflies to be concentrated in an area, and then the birds were reacting to that. Because, of course, a dragonfly is a much better meal than a little tiny midge or something. So that would be my first guess. But as I said, there are times we've seen these observations, and at best we're guessing biologically what's happening, but we're not totally sure.
And thanks again for calling in. Anne in Madison, hi to you.
Hi. I was just wondering, this we've had now for several years at our cabin in Endeavor, problem with what somebody said was Rose Schaefer beetles. And they ate all the little tiny, tiny grapes when they were when they first formed. They're like pinheads.
Yeah.
And they also defoliated our young apple tree.
Mm-hmm.
What?
What can you do?
Okay. Well, the first thing is it's a creature we only find on light soils, on sands. And that's why you don't find it in Madison, because we don't have the right soil types. Start showing up about the 15th of June. And like Japanese beetles, they're migrating in. And so knowing calendar-wise, they're pretty easy to predict. If you have susceptible plants, you're probably going to have to protect them, whether if you put netting on them or use sprays. One of the other options you can consider, but it's going to be kind of tough in a cabin because you're kind of coming and going. You know, we don't like Japanese beetle traps. They honestly can make things worse, but there are some rose chafer traps out there that have some possibility of helping reduce the amount of plant damage you've got. You have to special order them out of Michigan. You can find on the internet. There's a Great Lakes IPM is the one company I know that sells it. There may be others. And they look just like a Japanese beetle trap. They use a different kind of chemical. And if you put these off on the edges, you can draw enough beetles to that. And we've had some luck with it. As I said, I have no faith for this for Japanese beetles, but for the rose chafer, we have had some success. But that trap has to be purchased in operable by the 10th of June, I would tell you, because if you let it go much later, they're already on you, and by the time you get the stuff shipped to you, it's going to be over. So,
thank you so much for calling in. Phil, thank you so much. I think we have a record for beautiful photographs on our Facebook page. There's another one. Jay Gilbertson just sent us one that's just gorgeous. But you'll come back and be with us again, I hope.
No, definitely, definitely.
All right. He's. Are you working on your book, by the way, yet?
I am working on my book, but, you know, the thing I have to confess to everybody is I thought this was going to get written a lot earlier. I'm having too much fun enjoying things, and you get a nice day, and it's just hard to write. So I did make progress in the winter, and I am still working at it, but
all right.
We're not there yet.
All right. Phil Pelletieri, Distinguished Faculty Associate Emeritus at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, our guest today, and he will be back. So that is very good news. Tomorrow we'll talk about current scams to look for throughout the state with our guests from the Department of Ag, Trade, and Consumer Protection. Please stay with us.